We have a quorum, and today we will be hearing from the Department of Employment and Economic Development, also known as DEED. We will be discussing the internal controls, policies, and procedures that are in place to prevent and root out any possible fraudulent behavior in the Paid Family and Medical Leave Act that will be taking effect on January 1st, 2026. First, before we get started, we will move the minutes. Vice Chair Anderson, would you like to move the minutes from September 17th?
So moved.
Oh, actually, from October 14th. Is there any discussion on the October 14th minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Minutes are approved. First, just so everyone understands the order, we will start with Deputy Commissioner Rowe from DEED and Deputy Commissioner from Minute, John Eichten. And then we'll have some public testimony, and then we'll go to member discussion. So, Mr. Rowe, would you like to join us? And your colleague from Minute is welcome to join us as well. Good morning. Thank you for coming to the committee. Please state your name for the record and just begin your testimony.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Evan Rowe. I am Deputy Commissioner for Workforce Services and Transformation at the Department of Employment and Economic Development, and I have programmatic responsibility for Minnesota's paid leave program. Really happy to be here with you all today. And should I have Deputy Commissioner Eichten state his name for the record at this point, too, Madam Chair?
That would be great. Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the record. My name is John Eichten. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for Minnesota IT Services. Thank you.
Okay, so we have a walkthrough today on paid leave and program integrity. Our agenda here is brief. We're going to just provide some brief background on the paid leave program to root the discussion, and then we'll have a hopefully fulsome discussion on program integrity and look forward to the discussion. So just to root the committee in background on the paid leave law, the paid leave law was enacted in 2023, and the program officially begins January 1st, 2026. The law provides job protections and payments from the state to individuals who need time off to care for themselves or loved ones. Premiums are made up of contributions from both employees and employers that will fund the program, and paid leave will send benefit payments directly to Minnesotans on leave. And just a little bit why it matters, right? Minnesota is going to be the 13th state to implement paid leave. Only 7 countries worldwide don't have some sort of national paid leave program, and 73% of American workers lack access to paid family leave through their employers. States that have implemented paid leave programs have seen stronger employee retention, better health and development outcomes for children, higher labor market attachment for women and labor force participation generally, and greater economic security for families. In terms of what is covered under the law, any individual component of leave is available from 1 to 12 weeks. There's the program split into 2 major buckets. Medical leave is exactly what it sounds like. It's time to care for oneself in the event of a serious healthcare diagnosis or condition. These are conditions that last at least 7 days. And then as far as family leave goes, there's a few different types of leave. There's parental bonding leave. There's military family leave. There's caring leave to care for a family member with a serious health condition. And there's safety leave, leave because of domestic abuse, sexual assault, or stalking of an individual or an individual's family member. Now, any one type of leave is eligible up to 12 weeks. There is a maximum of 20 weeks combined in 1 year if someone combines 4 both types of leave. I think the most common scenario in that case would be a complicated pregnancy where a birthing parent would have might have health conditions and complications during the pregnancy and then have time to care for parental leave. And again, I'll just note, qualifying conditions must last more than 7 days and they must be certified by a health care provider or the other specified provider under the law. I do just want to touch briefly on public engagement because this is a program that's going to touch pretty much every Minnesotan. And we've really tried to prioritize connection and engagement around the state. We've made over 33,000 individual connections and had over 300 engagement activities. Since late 2023, got a bunch of numbers and stats down below if that would be helpful for members of the committee. But I would just emphasize that we really have tried to build this program with Minnesotans, and really have valued the feedback that we have gotten at every stage of the process from employers, from future applicants, and from healthcare providers and across the state. So this is going to tie in a little bit just to our overall approach. Our strategy for success in the paid leave for the paid leave program is to launch incrementally, right? Not have one big thing go live at once, but to launch individual pieces of the program as you go, to test them and make sure that they're ready for prime time. We launched, as an example, we launched combined wage detail reporting with unemployment insurance all the way back in October of 2024. And this is something that saves employers a lot of time in terms of not having to submit repetitive, duplicative wage detail records. We have already, as you might be aware, opened bonding leave claim submissions with two of the state's largest employers, and we are already accepting and processing those claims ahead of the January 1st implementation date. We aim to open bonding leave claim submissions to all Minnesotans in the next few weeks, again, ahead of the January 1st timeline. That's to, again, make sure that that Minnesotans are able to get applications in and that employers have plenty of time to be ready for the law. We'll get into this in a little bit, but we are leveraging Minnesota IT services that are already in operation, like LoginMN, to support security and program integrity. We've applied service design best practices to get early insights from real people and refine the product constantly. And we've continuously gathered feedback to improve the system every single day. So, this approach, we think it ties into best practices for service delivery management and high program integrity. And now we can get into some of the details around program integrity. So, there's no, as I'm sure members of this committee are aware, there is no one silver bullet for program integrity. You got to have a combination of people, process, and technology. The slides that follow are going to outline some of the key program integrity components across all three fronts. Now, we're in this hearing, in a public hearing, we're not going to go into all of the, every single piece of secret sauce because it is a public hearing. We're obviously happy to answer follow-up questions as members may have them, but I hope that this overview will give members a really good understanding of our overall approach and how we're doing it. So people, process, technology is one lens you can take. The other way to think about it is at the various elements in any specific paid leave application. So you have the applicant, right? How are we ensuring program integrity at a high level? You have ID verification through LoginMN or administrative data. You've got a modern application to address those eligibility criteria, and we have a detailed program integrity flag and alert process to catch issues and address those before payments go out. On the employer side, you also have ID verification through their joint UI and paid leave account, and you have a dedicated employer role for review on every application under the paid leave law. ID verification for healthcare providers comes through licensure information on this and the certification that is required on every application. And administrative data is a critical component of all of this as well. You have integrations across multiple state agencies. We have very detailed linkages with the unemployment insurance system and automated financial eligibility and benefit calculation processes. And we'll get into that in a bit more detail as we go along. I'll next hand it over to Deputy Commissioner Eichten to talk a little bit more about LoginMN, which is, I think, a really key and exciting component of the paid leave application process.
Deputy Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Again, for the record, my name is John Eichten. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for Minnesota IT Services. Happy to be here today to talk about some of the foundational elements that make up the overall fraud mitigation strategy for the paid leave program. In particular, I'm here to talk about a new service we as Minute are rolling out thanks to funding provided in the 2023 legislative session. This service relates to how we manage identities and how we manage access to state systems when we're engaging with residents, service delivery partners, county workers, where, of course, those interactions are increasingly taking place online. A quote that's often cited in the cybersecurity world is that you can have security without privacy, but you can't have privacy without security. The same could be said of the relationship between fraud prevention and cybersecurity. That is, we can work to ensure our state technology systems are protected from breaches, we can harden them, we can prevent unauthorized access, but that alone will not ensure that fraudsters are not able to manipulate our programs. However, if we want to ensure overall program integrity, that is impossible If we cannot ensure that the people who are provided access to state systems, whether they're residents, again, county workers, service providers, are in fact who they say they are and are only able to access the information and system capabilities that they need. So at its core, that's the function of LoginMN. In terms of our tangible goals, we're looking to provide a digital front door to all public-facing digital services that are offered by state agencies, in particular those that require credentials, which is a username, a password to log in order to interact with the program online. In doing so, we can simplify the user experience. We can eliminate the need for separate login credentials for different programs, be that healthcare programs, unemployment insurance, paid leave, and we can implement additional security and identity proofing capabilities while spreading the cost of those capabilities across several programs and state agencies. This includes multi-factor authentication, which I'm sure you're all used to if you have a bank account that you interact with online, where users can select the method they prefer, be that a text message, a phone call, a passkey, as well as three levels of identity proofing to help ensure that fraudsters are not able to pass through the state's digital front door using false identities. These identity proofing levels provide state programs the ability to set the identity proofing requirements at the appropriate level, given the risk of fraud and the sensitivity of data available to particular user roles. Because while we may choose to require that someone provide identity proofing documentation, like a driver's license, a live photo of themselves for a service such as paid leave, we may not need to create a similar barrier for those looking to purchase saplings from the DNR nurseries. Of course, this service was built with an eye toward regulatory compliance, be that HIPAA, CMS requirements, PUB 1075, as well as with an eye toward usability, accessibility, and customer experience, recognizing that we will continue to evolve the service as agency needs and customer needs evolve. I was noted on the previous slide, but we also see an added benefit here in providing assurance to residents that they're in fact operating with a state program and not a scam website that's looking to steal their money or their personal information. Lastly, I did want to highlight from a security standpoint the comprehensive approach being taken to testing the paid leave application itself. From day one, we in Minute and Deed have been stressing the need for high standards of quality, not only in terms of hardening the system from infiltrators, bad actors, but also ensuring the system's highly usable, functional for Minnesota residents and businesses interacting with the system. This means testing each of the components individually, building in automated checks and cleansing processes into our code development processes, throwing large volumes of traffic at the system to simulate high volume events, engaging end users to collaboratively identify and resolve system defects, testing to ensure Minnesotans with visual or other disabilities can interact with the system, as well as independent penetration testing to ensure the system is hardened against a potential targeted and persistent external cyber attack. Our vendor partner in this effort, Nava, has clearly demonstrated that they share these commitments. They've been working with us every step of the way to ensure this system is fully tested and ready for launch. And I want to commend Deed leadership for heeding the recommendations of the Technology Advisory Council in their approach to implementing paid leave technology. This commitment has been demonstrated in many ways, developing policy with implementation in mind from the get-go, involving users in development and testing of the system, and recognizing that this new service is really a digital product that must be designed and evolved with not just the needs of government in mind, but the needs of the customers and users at the center, be them an HR team member at 3M or a first-time mom trying to plan their next 6-12 months. With that, Madam Chair, I'm happy to answer any questions you or the committee may have. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you.
I should hand back for the remainder of the presentation.
Yes, Mr. Rowe, why don't you continue? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. So now we'll, so thanks to Deputy Commissioner Eichten for kind of going into some of the IT components and the LoginMN component. We'll talk a little bit more generally about application controls going forward here. And, you know, I think it's good to start with the application process just to think about how this whole thing flows. I'd want to emphasize that the employee, the employer, and the paid leave division all play a role in the application process at a very high level. It's five steps. First, the employee notifies their employer about their intention to take leave. Then the employee starts an application for paid leave. Then they submit it, and the paid leave administrator is asked to review the application. The paid leave division adjudicates the application with the feedback from the employer as part of it. And finally, the employee and the paid leave administrator are notified of a determination. What are these controls? How do they actually come together, right? So I'll note that, you know, I kind of initially noted a people process technology lens you can take, and people are a critical part of this. The claims review teams in the paid leave program are fully staffed, and as I mentioned earlier, are already reviewing applications from a couple early launch partners. Those teams are supported by robust internal processes and integrity tools, including data analytics to spot trends and ensure high program integrity. And we have a really robust training and information sharing program to ensure that that those application reviews are happening with high integrity. That's supported by business logic, right? Business logic and application design support accuracy and integrity, and good application design makes it easy for applicants to do the right thing. It makes it harder for fraudsters to do the wrong thing. So what do some of these process controls look like, right? You've got an internal controls plan and risk management policies to provide structure for those teams to do their work. You've got annual risk assessments for business activities to ensure an updated posture and ensure that they are responding to emerging threats. It is a constantly evolving threat landscape, and we stay and we work very hard to stay on top of that. We have risk committees and information sharing to address incipient issues that may come up ad hoc. We have a variety of business processing controls built into the application. If you use the paid leave application, you will see that it is a very structured information gathering process, in many ways similar to the unemployment insurance application. And that is by design. It is meant to ensure that we are getting data in a structured manner that allows for analytics and careful analysis of any application. I'll note that there are random audits, there are administrative and criminal penalties for malfeasance, both in the statute and elaborated in rulemaking. And we have collaboration with a variety of interagency partners, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, the State's Information Security Office, Log and Amend, as Deputy Commissioner Eichten mentioned, the Office of the Legislative Auditor, and other appropriate parties as necessary to ensure that the law is upheld. And we take that very seriously. I want to talk a little bit about the employer role as far as the application goes. This is an important part. Employers are able to review leave applications submitted by their employees. They can confirm the information submitted by employees is correct. They can track the status of applications. They can view past determinations made by the division. And they're going to be able to access benefit information for tax purposes. And this little animation that you have playing on the screen right now really just kind of shows what that experience is going to look like and already does look like for employers. This is a very useful component of the application for us because it allows an employer to raise their hand and say, something doesn't look right, and the department will review that information and take appropriate action as needed to ensure that remains with high integrity. And that kind of goes into the overall reporting control as far as the application goes, right? You have confirmation of facts as represented. You have multiple points of validation. You have appealable records, which allows for another control that layers in to the overall process. And we have a fraud reporting portal online today, as well as anybody can call our customer contact center or send us an email to provide tips and feedback that may be necessary. One other control that the paid leave program has is provider certification. So all claims are required to be certified by a healthcare provider or the appropriate professional. We will review and validate provider information, and we will conduct analyses on those data to support program integrity. One other really exciting thing that I wanted to just preview for this committee is that in early 2026, we're going to be launching integrations with electronic health record systems such as Epic, and as well as access to ICD-10 codes for providers to help with duration estimation. This is groundbreaking. Minnesota is going to be the first state in the country to integrate directly with EHRs, and there's a host of process and integrity benefits that we're really looking forward to and hope to pioneer a new level of program integrity with this. Another item that I'd mentioned that I previously referenced is that we're leveraging our unemployment insurance and agency data. I was in front of this committee back in April, where we talked a little bit about some of the unemployment insurance controls and approaches. You know, again, Minnesota is a top performing state when it comes to unemployment insurance program integrity. I think this is something that has been reviewed by multiple parties, including the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And what we're really trying to do is leverage the UI program's expertise and data to validate requests and enhance paid leave program integrity. You know, like I mentioned earlier, integrating the wage detail records with unemployment insurance it's helpful on multiple fronts. It makes it easier for employers to fulfill their reporting requests. It also provides a very rich administrative data set that the paid leave team can use to ensure that wage detail records are accurate, that employer records are accurate, and that we are able to ensure that people are indeed who they say they are. And it's not just unemployment insurance. We have a variety of integrations with other agencies, such as the Department of Public Safety, to provide additional support. So in summary, paid leave has multiple layers of controls in place to ensure high program integrity. These controls encompass people, process, and technology, and leverage tools and data from UI and across the state. I also want to emphasize that our work is never done. We're going to continue to develop and deliver solutions that further strengthen the program. I think, one of the most important part of the people element of people, process, and technology is the brains, right? We want humans that are thinking about how we can ensure really strong program integrity and continuously seek to improve our efforts in that regard. Because this is really important. This all works together to ensure that Minnesotans are going to be able to count on the paid leave program in those moments that matter, and that we're running this program with high integrity. So, Madam Chair, I'm happy to stop here and answer any questions. I think you also mentioned that you might have testifiers, so whatever's best.
Thank you, Mr. Rowe. Mr. Ecton, we are going to move to public testimony, but if you would just stay close, I'm sure we have many questions for you when we get to that point. Thank you. First up, we will have Troy Redding. If you could join us at the testifier table. Thank you for joining us. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, members. My name is Troy Redding, and I own and operate Ally Restaurants, which operates Holman's Table here in St. Paul and Rock Elm Tavern in Plymouth. We currently employ 105 people to operate our two locations and our food truck. We're extremely proud of the culture we've built at Ally Restaurants, providing our employees with a flexible and inclusive work environment, and offering health care, including mental health care, that's fully funded by us as the employer, with a robust PTO program for our salaried and back-of-house employees, and an opt-out company matching 401k. Over time, I have raised concerns with the implementation of paid family leave program. Specifically, I'm concerned at what protections are in place to prevent fraud and how DEED will prevent misuse. A challenge we have seen with earned sick and safe time, which the Department of Labor is working to address through rulemaking, is misuse. For example, if we have an employee utilizing ESST, creating a gap in our staff for the day, their colleagues take on the responsibility. While frustrating, this is generally short-lived. However, it impacts the trust on our team. For example, a team member takes off for EST, but is posting pictures on social media, traveling, or not using ESST for the intended purposes. My concerns with paid family leave and fraud stems from generally removing the employer from the leave process. Now our employees will work directly with the state agency for extended periods of leave. We are concerned with the mechanisms that will be in place at DEED to verify that an employee is appropriately caring for the designated individual on leave. What are the mechanisms in place to preclude an individual from working a second job in Minnesota or in another state as they are caring for their loved one? How will I as an employer be able to validate, raise abuse issues with the program? Will it mirror the UI program where I have the ability to deny or rebut the claim? Thank you, Madam Chair and committee for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us. Next up, we have Lars Negstad. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, Chair Robbins and committee members. My name is Lars Negstad, and I serve as the policy director for ISAIAH. No matter where we live or what we look like, Minnesotans believe in caring for one another, yet the vast majority of Minnesotans don't yet have access to paid family and medical leave benefits. That's why ISAIAH was so proud to partner with a broad range of organizations to fight for paid family and medical leave. Few programs or policies in Minnesota have been as thoroughly studied, planned, researched, vetted, debated, discussed, deliberated, and voted on as paid family and medical leave. In 2015, a study was commissioned by the legislature. In 2016, the Senate passed paid family leave. In 2019, 2020, 2021, and 2022, the House passed paid family and medical leave. Finally, it was passed by both chambers and signed into law in May 2023. Then in 2024, the House broke previous records of deliberation on this policy with an 8-hour-plus floor debate on the 52-page paid family and medical leave cleanup bill. As hundreds of small business owners, medical professionals, and personal caregivers have testified in dozens of hearings over the past decade, the need for this program is urgent and the benefits are numerous. I was encouraged by your committee administrator to keep my remarks short, so I won't list all those benefits here. As you can tell, I'm a passionate advocate for paid leave, having spent the past 11 years working for it. No one would be more offended by failures in the program, especially intentional fraud and misuse of the system, than would I. I've been in communication with research partners from several national organizations supporting paid leave development and implementation. I've attended multiple national convenings with state and agency administrators of paid leave, and I am confident that Minnesota Paid Leave has put together a highly regarded team that is taking every measure necessary to implement a strong and successful program. I'd like to draw your attention to the fact sheet from the national organization, A Better Balance, that's provided in your packet. As stated in this fact sheet, data from both the federal FMLA and the 13 states that have implemented paid family and medical leave programs provides clear and consistent evidence. Because these programs have been thoughtfully designed, abuse and fraud are exceedingly rare. Minnesota's paid leave is a robustly designed program, intentionally built on our highly respected UI system, that includes annual reporting requirements, multiple cross-checks, including healthcare provider certification, the 7-day qualifying event requirement, and a benefit that only partially replaces wages. The one area where I would encourage increased vigilance is in the private plan options. While examples of individual fraud are exceedingly rare and small scale by definition, we have copious examples of fraud in the for-profit insurance industry. For example, United Health Group has been accused of overbilling the federal government to the tune of $2 billion, among many other misdeeds. The strength of the 13 states with paid leave programs is that they are overwhelmingly delivered through highly accountable public administration and thus are less susceptible to corporate corruption. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for joining us. Next up, Melissa Heising. If I'm pronouncing that right, I'm sorry. Forgive me. Thank you for coming, and please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Melissa Heising, and I am Legislative Director at Minnesota AFL-CIO, the State Labor Federation, representing most public sector, private sector, and building trades unions across the state. We co-chaired the Minnesota Paid Leave, Minnesotans for Paid Leave Coalition, which advocated for the creation of this program so all workers, both union and non-union, can take the time they need to care for themselves and their loved ones. Because we wanted this program to succeed, we supported policy provisions that reflected lessons learned and best practices from other states, including guardrails to prevent fraud that are reflected in the paid leave statute. Among those best practices was to require certification from a healthcare provider on both the need for and duration of the leave. Another was to ask the state to administer the program rather than outsourcing it to a third party. As we have seen, for example, with Medicare Advantage plans, outsourcing the administration of public benefits to for-profit corporations can open the door to large-scale waste, fraud, and abuse while harming the people who are supposed to be receiving the benefit. And based on the experience of other states, fraud committed by workers is very rare. In California, only 0.00012% of paid family and medical leave claims were investigated for fraud. And in Massachusetts, out of over 32,000 denied applications, less than 200 were because the application contained false statements. Compare those numbers to what we know in Minnesota about rates of fraud committed by some employers through worker misclassification. The Office of the Legislative Auditor estimates that 22% of employers subject to an employment audit misclassified at least one worker in 2018. And an analysis by North Star Policy Action showed that approximately 9.4% of private sector workers in Minnesota, about 316,000 workers, experienced worker misclassification. This means the worker can be wrongfully denied access not only to paid leave, but to all of the rights and benefits associated with employment. We encourage both DEED and this committee to also focus on preventing this type of fraud so that all workers who are eligible have access to this important program. Thank you.
Thank you for coming. All right, now it is time for member discussion. So Mr. Rowe and Mr. Acton, if you wouldn't mind returning to the table, I'm sure we have several questions for you. Thank you very much. I think I'll start us off. As you know, one of the missions of this committee is not only to find fraud and hopefully stop it, but we want to try to prevent it on the front end. And this is a unique opportunity that we are looking at a program that has not actually taken effect yet. And so we feel this is a place where we can hopefully make an impact by having a hearing on the front end to make sure we understand the fraud prevention policies and internal controls you have in place, and I appreciate your testimony today. I have to say, there's a lot there, but a lot of it, you know, wasn't very detailed, so I'm going to have a few specific questions, and if it's something that you can't say on the record, I would appreciate a in-person follow-up later. So just briefly, you mentioned that there are penalties for misuse in statute and in administrative rules. So could you outline for me what the penalties are for fraud or misuse?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes. So the statutory citation would be Section 268B.185 under benefit overpayments. There's three, I guess you could say that there are three tiers of overpayments contemplated under the law, and this largely mirrors the unemployment insurance statute. There are some overpayments where, through no malicious intent, a good faith error by an applicant, there may be an overpayment issued. There's no criminal penalty, but the individual is expected to repay the department for those, for any overpayments. And, if the overpayment is not repaid, the department has the ability under the law to collect on the balance. The second level I would call is this is a phrase from UI law, misrepresentation. So misrepresentation, just quoting from the statute, is in a case where an applicant makes an intentional false statement or representation in an effort to fraudulently collect benefits. Again, those are not your unintentional mistakes or your good faith errors. That's where somebody is attempting to, is attempting to game the system. The law requires us to issue a penalty of 15% of the amount overpaid. And then we have a variety of methods that we can use to recover the overpayment, as well as the penalty and any interest assessed. The third and I would say most severe level would be theft. So that's subdivision 3 of that section of the statute. And that's where I would say generally that's kind of where you have a more detailed, like it's a deeper level of coordination of actions, of attempts to defraud the state, and that contemplates criminal penalties, where we would presumably refer a case through the BCA or to county prosecution for criminal prosecution in that case. I think the way to think about it, right, is you probably don't want to prosecute every single example. Some should be dealt with administratively. But I think the statute gives us varying levels of tools based on the level of seriousness of the offense, and the department will attempt to use that to ensure high levels of program integrity.
Thank you. And when there is an error or actual misrepresentation, how often are you sort of auditing these payments so that it would be flagged either by technology or by someone reviewing it? And then is your intention to go after every overpayment and have it repaid, or how are you going to seek repayment?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So just in terms, I guess, to start with, we will pursue any time there are payments made, that are not entitled to, that the individual is not entitled to, whether it is through, a good faith error or whether it is through, criminal malfeasance, we will seek to recover those balances. Again, there are different ways that we can do that. You can offset against future benefits. We can seek to go into more detailed collection methodologies if that is what is required to do so. We do have the authority under the statute to do liens, levies, and other types of collections methodologies. The latter would probably be contemplated only in the most serious occasions. I think in the case of the unemployment insurance program, most things can be are done kind of internally to the program rather than having to do it that way. I guess to the first part of your question, how are we going to be analyzing? The answer is constantly, right? Both at the point of application, right, to validate the information in the ways that we spoke to throughout the presentations. Additionally, as I mentioned, there are going to be random audits and reviews that we will be, that we'll be conducting as part of the program. And should we get reports from external parties, such as an employer or such as a concerned citizen reporting, providing us with information, we will review those carefully and act upon them as appropriate.
Thank you. So just to follow up on that quickly, you mentioned offsets against future benefits. That seems to be a way the state handles overpayments in many other areas. Is that going to be your first way you will address this, or will you lean into collections or cash repayment somehow?
Madam Chair, I think it will depend on the scenario. Again, I would say that for your typical good faith, error, an offset of benefits is the simplest and cleanest approach for everybody, right? Like that is a case where an individual may have made an error on the application. There's no need for them to send us a check and then we apply that check to their account. That can just get messy for everybody involved. So I think, where possible, offsets are a very straightforward approach. But again, that won't be appropriate in every case. If somebody has entirely, misrepresented the record and they were indeed not entitled to benefits and, there are no benefits to offset, then we would need to seek collection in other manners.
Thank you very much. All right, Vice Chair Anderson.
Thank you. I have, I'll start out, I have some technical questions. So I am actually an employer, and I'm the administrator for several companies. So I've been watching your webinars and everything.
Thank
so
you.
They're actually quite good. But I have a, I'll start with, on the, first of all, I think it's a good that we did this as a combination with UI. The data's there. It's easier on the employer. Are you look backdating it, though? Are you looking at the last quarterly, when you're looking at, you know, earnings records, are you looking at the last quarterly 941 that was filed? Or how do you do that?
Madam Chair, can I just seek to clarify the question there? Are you talking about in terms of calculations for the benefits, or are you talking about the employer records? Just which element of the calculations are you asking about?
Thank you. It would be the calculation of benefits. And I know that people don't need to actually be employed. Like, they could have been unemployed and still collect it. So that's not an issue. I guess it would be calculation.
Madam Chair, thanks for the clarification. So the look-back period is generally the last four, and in some cases five, depending on the timing of the application, quarters of wage records. That's what the statute prescribes for us. And the benefits are generally assessed, are generally attributed to the high quarter of earnings, just given that individuals may have some level of variability in their overall earnings patterns.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions?
I have a bunch, but I'll try to be quick. So these are all really technical questions. Guidance to healthcare providers, too. I guess that's not technical, but are you providing that? I'm really concerned about the intermittent leave. The pregnancy leave is, you know, there's either a baby or not, right? So it's the medical leave part and the intermittent. And then how are you going to deal with someone that has two employers?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Rowe.
Madam Chair, let me try to answer each question in sequence. So medical leave, I guess I would just, you know, what I would say is I'd kind of go back to the presentation, right? So, you know, we've been working really closely with healthcare providers. Just last week had a really good session with the Minnesota Hospital Association about just kind of how this is going to work. I think a very positive and constructive discussion. We've had really deep engagement from some of the healthcare providers. Fairview Mayo Clinic, in terms of working to get the EHR, the electronic health records integration, which is going to really, I think, transform how doctors and other providers are able to provide some of that information to us and simplify administration in that regard. And that's also, I think, where some of the ICD-10 codes will come in. Well, that'll be yet another tool that medical providers are able to use. As far as intermittent leave goes, the rules are clear that an employee needs to stick to the intermittent leave schedule. If they take intermittent leave when they are not, on a schedule that they have not kind of submitted and gotten approved by the department, they are not not eligible to collect intermittent leave benefits during those periods. And all the guidance that I would say that we have as a division really tries to emphasize the need for constructive, collaborative conversations between the employer and the employee for intermittent leave, because that's going to be the best chance of success. That's going to be the lead to the best outcomes for success. I think you asked about multiple employers as well, right? So we do have, we have wage detail records for all employees across, for all employees in the state. We calculate the benefits based on total earnings, right? As an applicant, you're choosing whether you take leave from an individual employer or not, and that you can imagine why you might need to do that, right? If you have two part-time jobs, one that you're working on Mondays and Tuesdays, and one that you're working on Wednesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays, and you have a chemo appointment every Monday, you might not need to take leave from the Wednesday, Thursday, Friday job, but you might need to take leave, on that Monday from the Monday, Tuesday. So I think the law, the law and the benefit administration is designed to reflect those different pieces together.
Thank you. I know. One quick thought. So your webinar talks about migraines. So an employee has migraines, and because they have migraines, the doctor says, you know, occasionally they're going to have a migraine and they might need to be out intermittently. So how would you do a schedule for someone who says, oh, I have a migraine today, so I can't work today. And I might have one next Friday and the following Friday. And then also, how do you deal with this? The caregiver is really concerning to me. So we have, you know, the application says that any person that has a migraine could have three caregivers that also are off then to give psychological care, comfort to the person with a migraine. So how do you do that internally?
Mr. Rowe.
Madam Chair, Representative. So in the, you know, as a person who's occasionally had migraines, and I don't know if you know anybody who has, I mean, having somebody work under those, you know, that's a pretty tough circumstance overall. You know, I guess as far as the intermittent leave would go, right, I think it's, you know, I think it's something that we, you know, we hope you're going to, you know, it's something that we hope you're going to have, you know, again, conversations with the employer about, as, you know, as an employee, right? And I would think that any employer who sees an employee having a migraine, you know, and is having, you know, real struggles in terms of being able to do the work, I would hope that that would be a circumstance where, you know, where folks would be able to kind of figure out how that schedule can work. You know, I think when it comes to, can you just remind me the second part of your question? I'm sorry.
Vice Chair Anderson.
Thank you. The caregiver help.
Oh, yes.
So someone who has a migraine, which is your webinar, is uses a migraine as an excuse or as an example, they can have up to three people, caregivers, who provide psychological comfort to a person with a migraine. Is that?
Well.
And how do you deal with that?
Deputy Commissioner Rowe.
Madam Chair and Representative, thanks for the reminder. So I will note as part of the certification process, right, the healthcare provider signs off on the maximum number of absences, the duration for each, and for the period of time, and they also are certifying to the need for care for those specific caregivers, right? And I believe the certification, you know, the certification form, it, you know, kind of notes that. So it is not inherent, you know, it isn't just a case where an applicant can just tell the division, I need, you know, seven different people to care for me here. These are medically validated, medically certified items that are going to be validated by the care provider. And again, as I mentioned, we will be reviewing the records that we get from medical certifiers and reviewing those data to ensure integrity in the process.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So my concern is in the validation verification of multiple things. And one of the most glaring things that I found odd in both applications for both taking leave and then also providing care for someone who's taking leave is that an address is optional. Can you explain why on these applications the person applying or the caregiver doesn't have to provide their address?
Mr. Rowe.
Madam Chair, are you which component of the application are you referring to here?
Representative Rick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in every question where it's either an individual saying I need to take leave or I'm going to go take care of grandma down in Florida, which is an example you and I've talked about when we were crafting this, in all of those instances, the address is optional in every single, so that's what the online.
If I can help, it's the medical leave certification form and the caring leave certification form. Both say addresses are optional.
Okay. Oh, sure. No, so I get, Madam Chair, I guess what I would just say is that is certainly not the only place where we are going to be validating and verifying addresses, right? Obviously, as for the applicant, you know, and Deputy Commissioner Eichten can speak a little bit to the login MN components, but there is a very robust identity validation and proofing component there. For some of the certifications, there may be scenarios where it's not safe for an applicant to share an address, such as safety leave, right? Like that is an area where it would not be, you know, we would not want that to be for reasons I'm sure you can understand, that would not be something that we would want to do. But the medical certification, form, which is modeled on the FMLA certifications that, you know, I think employers are already using, you know, is not the, I guess, is not the only point of address or other identity verification. Far from it. These are data that we are also collecting as part of the application workflow and those components as well.
Representative Burke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So let's go to something a little harder. The service provider, that was an easy one. The service provider can be in a foreign country. And you had talked about you were going to verify all of these service providers. And the list is very, very broad, everything from an advanced practitioner, nurse, practicing nurse, to a mental health professional without any qualifications as with, well, maybe it's a statutory qualification. Mm-hmm. But my concern is how do you validate somebody that's in Mozambique?
Mr. Rowe.
Madam Chair, Representative, I would just say is we will be taking a very careful look at any of those types of applications and, as appropriate, contacting the relevant authorities. I think we are certainly aware of the potential for risk there, and obviously we have to follow the law and what the law prescribes there. But that is certainly an element that our program integrity unit will be carefully monitoring, and we will review with all due scrutiny in that regard.
Madam Chair, I have two more quick questions.
All right. Please be quick. Thank you.
Great. So the other two verification things that are of great concern to me is when we've got on here someone who has an expectation and a reliance on me to care for them without compensation. So I am not seeing anything in this application as to a supporting document or anything to verify. What does that even mean? How does one set up with another person that you're not related to an expectation or reliance for care? That's one question, and since I'm going to do this quickly, I'm going to do the second question. Also, as a person has been qualified to go ahead and offer care, how do you verify that that care is actually being provided and they're not just, as we had spoken in many hearings before, just going to Florida for a vacation and not really taking care of anybody?
Mr. Rowe.
So, thank you, Madam Chair. To the first part of the question, I'd offer a couple thoughts there. So, one, just to return to previous answer, the medical provider, right, is certifying to the need for care by that specific individual, right? So that is a component of it. You know, what are the scenarios in which, you know, you might have somebody who is, you know, who might not be related by blood, I would just say, you know, family and caregiving relationships, as I'm sure you are aware, are complex, right? And there are often cases where individuals are taking care of each other, where you might have an uncle, or you might have, a more distant family member who, because of circumstances and how those things have evolved over time, those are the ones who are providing care for each other. You know, families, I think, as we all know, are complicated. What I would say is, you know, there are data from other, you know, Washington State is a good example of a state that, you know, initially launched with a much smaller, or with a much more constrained definition and expanded their definition, I think in 2021 or 2022. They did an analysis on, you know, the number of individuals that actually, you know, who actually met that more kind of that broader family definition. And from memory, over the course of about 18 months, it was like 500 people in the entire state of Washington, which is a state of 7 million people. So it's, you know, you're not, you know, I think my sense of the intention of the law was to provide flexibility for, you know, complex family issues, but the, you know, overall dynamic here is that, you know, it's experience in other states has been that it's not a big part of the law. I would just reiterate, right, the medical certifying party is the entity that confirms the need for care and provides that information. But once again, if you are taking leave for that care, The employer has a role in providing information to us, as well as, you know, as well as all the other kinds of reporting elements that I walked through that can help ensure program integrity.
Thank you. Just to follow up on that before I move to Representative Elkins. So you said that the medical certification for the caregiver, that they would be a check on this because they would certify that that specific person is needed to provide the care. In fact, could the person who's needing the care just say, oh, I want, you know, my cousin, my aunt, my neighbor down the street, and the medical provider would just go along with the person's suggestion? They're not actually saying, oh, no, we need this particular person. Could you clarify what you meant by that?
I'm sorry, could you clarify? I apologize, Madam Chair. Could you clarify the question there? I just want to make sure I'm answering.
Yes. So when you were responding to Chair Rarick, I wrote down that you said that the medical provider will certify that the care is provided by that specific individual. And I'm just not clear how the provider will know, other than that it's a name on the paper. Will the provider meet the care provider? What's the threshold that you're saying that the medical provider will certify that specific individual is necessary to be the care provider?
Mm-hmm. Well, Madam Chair, I guess I think the answer there, right, is that the, you know, to be able to certify, right, like the individual needs to have a conversation with their medical provider, right? And the medical provider, you know, if they are going to sign their name to, you know, to such a certification, is going to need to ask that question, right? Like, what is the nature of this caregiving relationship? And I guess it's helpful to kind of think less in the abstract and more in like a specific example, right? Like, I think of like somebody who's trying to take a relative to chemotherapy, right? Like, I think a very, you know, the patient may need somebody to drive them to a chemotherapy appointment. They might need to certify a couple different individuals to be able to do that, right? And as part of this law, the medical provider would ask the individual, who's going to take you to these appointments? The individual, you know, I would say that the patient would presumably say, oh, it might be my son, and it might be, my daughter who's going to do that. You know, again, I think the other control here is, right, we're also looking at the family, you know, we're also looking at family leave from the perspective of the individual with the medical event, right? So that is another control. If you had, you know, 50 people, you know, trying to do that, that will raise alarm bells, and that would not be approved. But that's the kind of the dynamic we're talking about.
Thank you, Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And at this point, I just wanted to perhaps clarify a few things that I'm hearing from translate from ITEs into legislator-es. You heard the term ICD-10 referenced several times. So ICD-10 is the coding system used to collect information about a patient's diagnoses. Okay. So essentially what they're doing in order to validate that the person actually has this condition that they're claiming on their application, they're going off to the electronic health system from the provider, and they're reading the ICD-10 codes to determine, yes, this person really has been seen by a clinician, and that formal diagnosis has been provided. So building on that, typically, the medical services involved, the patient, the applicant is probably going to want to be compensated by their insurance company for the provision of the services involved, and in order to successfully file a claim for medical services, The services themselves will have a HCPCS or CPT code, and that code that describes the services has to be supported by a diagnosis code, an ICD-10 code that provides evidence of an indication of medical necessity. So those are tied together. So the record that these guys are tapping into will describe the services being provided and the diagnoses that are providing the justification for providing the services. So this is kind of revolutionary. We haven't seen this before, where a government is going into electronic health records using the standard interfaces and collecting objective information about a person's diagnoses and the services that they're receiving.
Thank you. Did you have any comments, Mr. Rowe?
10 out of 10.
So the second part is questions about the address validation. So here also we're seeing a fundamental shift about how we manage people's addresses. So instead of, making all the tracking that, DEED tracks their address and DHS tracks their address and DNR tracks their address, all of that information will now be managed through login MN, which is modeled after login.gov at the federal level. So if I'm logging in to check my federal Social Security or Medicare or my TSA PreCheck, I just have one login with the federal government through login.gov, and that's where they maintain all of the information about, where I live, yada, yada, yada. So it doesn't have to be collected and maintained by the individual agencies. When somebody sets up their login MN account, they'll supply all of that information. And so when they use those credentials to log in, the agency that's integrated with login MN will just get that information out of login MN.
Thank you. And to that point, to go back to the address verification, since we're having this discussion, I think my concern is that the address verification is for the caregivers, and it's not required, and it's for the person receiving the services. And so I see your point on the person, the applicant for the leave, but for the caregivers, I think given the history of what we've seen in the DHS fraud, where we've had multiple addresses with providers who may or may not exist, to not even require an address for the caregivers is problematic. And I think it should be reversed, that if someone has a true domestic violence or concern about safety, they should be able to petition and opt out of providing that address. But I think to just make addresses optional on the front end is probably, of an issue of concern that we should look at.
Madam Chair, if I may, I don't want to interrupt, but
Mr. Rowe.
But I would just note, caregivers in this case are applying to the department, right? So we need to get this. The caregiver needs to provide a certification form that they are providing care that is medically necessary. But we are validating their addresses when they are applying to the department for benefits here. I apologize if I was unclear about that, but If you are applying for family, if you are applying for care, caring leave, because you are going to be, providing care to a family member, you are giving us that information through login MN, and you are providing us that other validated information. The certification form is one component here, but we are still validating that you are indeed who you say you are, and that you are a real entity in all those components.
Mr. Acton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to put a bit of a finer point on that in terms of what we're actually going to expect of folks to prove that they are who they said they are, paid leave will be the first program at the state that's currently operating that is going to be requiring IAL2 level identity validation. So what that means is that whether it's a caregiver or whether it's a person taking leave for their own medical need, they will need to pass through login MN as that digital front door to validate their identity. They will be run against two levels of validation, a liveness check and a documentation check. What that means is they will need to take a picture. If you have an IRS.gov account, you've been through this. You need to take a picture of your driver's license, and then you need to take a selfie of yourself, and that needs to be uploaded into Login MN. The selfie is to prevent fraudsters who may try to use AI to scam identities. Our service providers, external service provider, then reviews that, uses tools on their end to ensure that the liveness check, picture, the image on the ID sufficiently match, and then approves that individual as IAL2 compliant. That then carries forth into the paid leave system and any other state system that's going to be using Login MN. Currently, these kind of identity checks, you know, in other areas are done via administrative data. So in the healthcare space, pinging the federal data hub, the IRS data hub for identity checking. This is really the direction that the industry is moving. As I said, if you've created an IRS account, you've been through this, and it's intended to provide essentially the highest level of identity validation that's available as an industry offering at the moment.
Thank you for clarifying that. And is that required every time they log in or just when they create the account?
So every time they log in, they will pass through that same front door, but they don't need to keep providing the ID and the selfie. We have other monitoring capabilities in place, like geolocation, like behavior telemetry of someone on the site, to prevent someone taking over an already approved account. I think that's the scenario you're getting at there. But no, we wouldn't require the person every time they log in to check something in their account, you know, to take another selfie, show their ID again. That wouldn't be probably wouldn't be onerous and not necessary given the other security layers that are in place to make sure account takeovers are detected and stopped.
Thank you. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Assistant Commissioner Rowe, you've been before this committee before. You know we place a lot of our attention on fraud. And given that, I'm assuming that you've spent the last couple of years thinking about what areas of fraud that you are anticipating to happen. Mm-hmm. So can you share with the committee what fraud Deed is anticipating?
Mr. Rowe.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Schultz, I guess what I would just first start with, right, is, you know, our objective, you know, in setting up any program, the state, and certainly this program, is to get, you know, is to, you know, do everything in our power to absolutely minimize those types of incidences. And with that being said, I think, you know, hopefully what you see in our presentation is that I think we understand that there are multiple vectors that these kinds of where fraudsters can attempt to attack state programs, certainly in ones that operate at scale, right? And we learned this in unemployment insurance. I think we've learned this in many different places. You know, I think when I presented to this committee back in April, you know, there's one vector I would just call cybercrime, right? Like you have entities that are attempting to, you know, spoof identification, you know, take over individual accounts, right? People who are not who they say they are and are attempting to use synthetic identities and the like to, you know, to attempt to obtain benefits that are not rightfully theirs. I think Deputy Commissioner Eichten kind of spoke to, Login MN is not the only component to that, but it's a very important validation part because a lot of that comes down to is making sure that an applicant is who they say they are, right? So that's maybe your front door. I would say then, you know, then there is just the question of integrity within the program itself, right? Are people telling us, if you are who you say you are you telling us the truth? Right, and those are that's the next layer of controls that I think we've tried to talk about. Right, multiple points of validation, multiple, you know, kind of overlapping ways of ensuring that we are validating that information and ensuring accuracy in those answers. Right, so and then you know. So I think those are kind of the two buckets that you can think about, and I would say that that's been. at the forefront of our planning, at the forefront of the way that we have been trying to set up this program, and at the forefront of the way we will run this program, to really make sure that we're leveraging all the data that we can, that we're asking the right questions, that to the extent that we can, we are validating the information in those questions. I think those are the ways that you combat malicious behavior, and you can ensure high levels of program integrity.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Roll, when I listen to everything that's been said today, there's a few key areas beyond what you just mentioned that appear to be burdensome for some. I think that this program, based upon what's been outlined in our conversation, whether it's today or the last few years, it's that there's a heavy burden that actually lies with the medical provider. I'm almost very curious as to what that additional feedback has been from those who are healthcare providers or from the hospitals. I almost think that your system doesn't work without a heavy role, and a huge amount of time for medical professionals in order to verify those who are going to be providing care and what sort of care they're going to be providing, and how to say that that is achieved. And then along that same line, no one in this room has actually heard how your agency or anyone through the process and program integrity is going to confirm what care is being provided by these care providers.
Mr. Rowe.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. I guess, so I think there's two parts to what you were saying. The first around, the conversations that we've had with medical providers. Again, I think we've had really constructive and productive ones. To a large extent, this isn't new for medical providers, right? I would offer a couple points, right? First, medical providers already do this under FMLA, the Family and Medical Leave Act of 1993, which is a federal, unpaid leave program. Medical providers are already providing those types of certifications for those type of events. So it's not it is not unfamiliar, right? And I'd also just say, as I've said, Minnesota is not the first state to roll out a paid family and medical leave program. We're going to be the 13th state in the country that's doing this. We're like the 180th in the world, I suppose. But 13th state, so you have medical providers who, have heard from their colleagues, colleagues around the country, and I'm certainly not saying it's not a change. It is a change, but I think we've tried to model our program on the best practices that we've seen around the country, and I genuinely think that the EHR integration that we're kind of previewing here is going to reduce administrative burden, not just for this program in a nation-leading manner, but it's also going to help. And it's going to help, medical providers on FMLA as well, right? I'm genuinely hopeful that this is going to be, fully acknowledging that this is a change, that this is going to be a component, really does work for, works across the entire spectrum. Could you remind me of the second part of the question?
Representative Schultz.
Absolutely. Thank you, Madam Chair. So the second part of the question, which has been a question that's been asked a few times now, and we don't have an answer to it, which is an area of concern, is who and how are we going to verify that the people who are providing care are providing care?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mr. Rowe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Representative Schultz. So I guess I would just go back to the previous answers, which is there are overlap. I would say that there are overlapping controls to ensure that this is occurring, right? You know, first of, I would note that we have I'd say really robust methods for people reporting issues that they see occurring, right? We have a fraud reporting form and other ways that folks can get in touch with us, and we really strongly encourage folks to use those. We are going to take those reports incredibly seriously as we do employment insurance and as we do in those other elements. Employers have the ability to both through the application process as well as through the administration of the program to let us know as well, right? That's another piece of the control process here, right? So I think there's not just one thing. I think these things fit together and overlap and provide multiple layers of ensuring that that people are following the rules and that people are playing on a level playing field.
Representative Schultz.
Madam Chair, and I'll seek to be brief here in this. Given the amount of times we've asked the question without any substantive answer, and with great respect to you, Mr. Rowe, what you just said and what you have said today is that there can be up to three caregivers per individual patient that can have some duty to perform care, but there is no way to verify and no one that is the true entity that is accountable for that verification. In essence, when you are one of these care providers, you receive the dollars in your bank account, you don't have to work, and there is no duty to provide any sort of verification or proof or evidence that you provided any ounce of care.
Yeah. Actually, Representative Greenman is next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking forward to a conversation about prior authorization reform if we want to talk about how to unburden healthcare providers in this economy. My sister's a nurse practitioner, and she says she spends 25% of her time responding to insurance companies on prior authorization. So to me, that's the bigger issue there. But more to what we're talking about here today, I think that there's been some conflating. Let's go back to what this program is, right? This is a partial wage replacement for folks who are taking time off to care for themselves, their child, or a family member or loved one who has a serious health condition. And that is different than when we have talked about some other kinds of providers. So I think calling a mother caring for their child a healthcare provider or a provider is a little bit misleading. And I think that the turn of phrase is important because our job here is to do two things, right? We are here to ensure that Minnesotans who are eligible for these programs, in this case, paid family medical leave, have access to it. And two, that we're protecting the taxpayer resources for this program that we at the legislature have allocated. And I think what's been really useful is we've seen a lot about that second piece, focusing on claims and claims validation and verification, which is really, really important. And that's really what almost all of this conversation has been about claims. People who are eligible or potentially eligible for this benefit, submitting a claim for this partial wage replacement, and how we're ensuring that person is eligible and is who they say they are and doing what they say they're doing. And we've had that whole robust conversation, which I think is really, really important. But our experience on this committee has been that the business model of fraud is not really with the claims issue. It's with the private provider issue. So we haven't seen, when we talk about Feeder Future, we don't see a lot of issues with claims of family seeking food for their kids. The issue was the providers and the lack of oversight of those providers. When we were talking about HSS, we were not talking that the big issue was not unhoused folks who were claiming to get services they weren't eligible for. I'm sure that there is that, but it seems like we've been working on it. It is the providers who are taking government resources in order to provide a service, and then the person coming to us in most cases saying that they didn't get it. In this case, it's less about the mom seeking bonding care with their kid that I'm worried about, because what the California, and again, part of the reason I'm not worried about it is because of the 20 minutes you just described of all of the checks and verifications and validations, and my good friend, Representative Elkins, who really understands the technology behind it, seems satisfied with where things are at. California's experience that we heard quoted, and I think is in our packet, of 0.0012% investigated claims fraud, to me tells me that we actually have a good handle on it. But there is another kind of fraud that we haven't been talking about, which Ms. Heising alluded to, which is a fraud or misrepresentation employer misclassification fraud. For folks who have not been on the labor committee or are really focusing on it, what it is when an employer is supposed to treat someone as an employee but misclassifies them as an independent contractor. The reason it matters to us here is, one, it hits both of those. It both means that those Minnesotans who were who should have been eligible for this benefit won't get it. But more importantly, I think, to this committee, is it means that the resources that legally these employers are required to pay for this employee are not being paid. And we have a report, and we will soon have a official study, but we have a report. The OLA said up to 22% of employers have misclassified at least one worker. We have a study that we are going to build on that says between $500 and $1.3 billion a year Minnesota loses in tax revenue. And that's not just that doesn't actually include paid family medical leave taxes, because we haven't included that's unemployment insurance, like $100 million, payroll taxes we're not getting, workers' compensation, workforce development account. And that is resources that are supposed to be coming to the government that are being stolen because people are being misclassified. And so I'm interested, and I did that roll up because I actually think we should, like, if what we're concerned about is resources being stolen from the government and people not getting the benefits they deserve, that is a very serious issue that crosses paid family medical leave, crosses unemployment insurance, crosses payroll taxes. So I hope we dig more into that. On this case, I'm interested in what, as Deed has been thinking about this, and I know Deed's been working with other agencies, like, how are you thinking about adding paid family medical leave and what that means for our work to combat misclassification and ensure that employers are paying into the programs and that people get the benefits they deserve or they're eligible for?
Mr. Rowe.
Madam Chair, Representative Greenman, thank you for the question. I think one thing, as I think you're aware, Deed has been working on in concert with several other agencies to combat misclassification through the partnership which the legislature enacted in the previous biennium. I think one thing that will make it, even more straightforward for paid leave to work to contribute to counteract that behavior is the fact that we have set up kind of many combined processes and records with the Unemployment Insurance Division. So kind of adding that lens into the analysis will not be particularly onerous or challenging for the division, and I think it'll also provide. It's another useful example of the stakes involved, right? This program is going to really matter for Minnesotans, and we certainly want all Minnesotans who are entitled to these benefits under the law to be able to access them in accordance with their legal rights.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you. Just to follow up, and this might be a parking lot, but if either this committee or the Workforce and Labor Committee invited you back, I would love to hear about what additional things we can do. We know that this is a rampant problem. Adding paid family medical leave just makes there another program that I think could incentivize. And sort of the business model of misclassification is folks don't pay, if they're not paying the benefits to workers, and then you're competing against the good, the high road employers who are, it's another sort of incentive for employers to skirt the law. I would love to, if you have recommendations now, or if you are up for thinking a little bit deeper about what more we can do, knowing that this is a problem that we continue to work on.
Thank you. Representative Rarick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just really quickly, because Representative Schultz asked the question that I had asked earlier and re-asked it again. Mm-hmm. So you were talking about the upper limit of caregivers that can take leave and go take care of someone. And on the application, there's three. And you had said, well, if they had 50 people that applied, that would be rejected. And I appreciate that because you and I have had that conversation previously in committee where I said, well, what if 50 people wanted to go take a vacation in Florida and they just filled out all this paperwork and left? So I don't recall that there was an upper limit in statute, but have you established some sort of upper limit of how many caregivers can take care of someone? I know it's more than three, and it's less than 50, as you just said. So where did we land in all of that?
Mr. Rowe.
Madam Chair, thank you. No, I appreciate the question. And maybe just to go back to the, just to go back briefly to the point around, you know, kind of the process checks, right? I think there's a there is a balance in program design in terms of making sure that, you know, ensuring combining program integrity while also making sure that you've got a realistic approach to program administration, right? As I mentioned, right, I think we've got we have a variety of overlapping controls. And again, I would not understate the value of the employer role or the value of integrity reports that we get from people or, you know, from employers or just concerned citizens around the around the state, kind of providing us with that information. It is information that we absolutely act upon. It is information that is tremendously valuable in terms of providing, in terms of ensuring that the program is going to operate in the way that that we expect it to. I need to confirm just the exact rulemaking or administrative site just to get that answer back to you. But I guess just from a broad perspective, you know, we have program, you know, our program integrity unit is, you know, exists to ensure that we have checks in place when there are multiple caregivers in place, right? Again, family situations are complex. But I think that we understand to the question earlier that there are multiple vectors here, and we are going to be extremely careful about thinking about how those pieces can be put in place to ensure that the system is being respected, that that individuals are only getting the benefits that they're entitled to. I think Deputy Commissioner Eichten had a quick thought.
Mr. Eichten.
Madam Chair, thank you. I just wanted to ensure I understand the scenario you're describing, and also just sort of play out for a moment, if I'm understanding correctly, what that might look like. I think I'm envisioning a group of people who coordinate with each other to set up that Florida vacation. That would require that all of them who are going to list themselves as caregivers would come to the paid leave site. They would take a picture of they will be forced to take a picture of their face with their phone. They'll be forced to take a picture of their driver's license. They'll know that they will be essentially attesting to a condition that isn't true. They will be engaged in a conspiracy in order to get half of their usual salary for a short period of time. They will be putting themselves in a great deal of risk for prosecution for quite a meager benefit. And I just want to encourage us that in any state program to eliminate the potential for fraud, 100%. We would either need to not operate the program, or we would need to staff the program to such a degree that the cost of running it would start to get close to the cost of the benefits being provided. And so as we think about fraud, as we think about the technology and the people involved in combating fraud, we need to look at this from a bit of an ROI type perspective, look at the risk level, have layers of security, fraud detection, fraud mitigation in place. But if the goal is impossibility, I don't think that is a realistic idea to have as our it is our North Star but the cost of achieving it would be incredibly significant, given a risk that I think we need to put in context here, and that there are legal remedies in place for. And that would be pretty obvious with any kind of data analytics approach that was applied to the situation.
Can I just follow up with a quick clarification?
Representative Burke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick clarification. This is a conversation that Deputy Commissioner Rowe and I had had early on as we were crafting this as a legislature, and I had posed the question, well, if Grandma was in Florida and Grandma needed care, I'm not saying that nobody in Florida needs care. My specific scenario, which is I took the shortcut because Deputy Commissioner Rowe knows what I'm talking about. But clearly what I was trying to say was if Grandma in Florida clearly needed care, and we'd have that conversation, well, can two people go care for her? Sure. Can 10? Yes. Can 20? Can 30? Can 40? Can 50? Mm-hmm. And when we were crafting this as the legislature, there really wasn't a good answer to that. And I'm not saying that there isn't somebody there that needs care. I'm saying that there is. But I'm saying that you would have so many caregivers come all at the same time to a very nice place, and maybe it's December, January, February, where it's not so nice here. I'll go down there at the same overlapping time. Mm-hmm. And my question to Deputy Commissioner Rowe at that time was actually, can you see that in the database, which at that point hadn't even been built? So really that was more so the question, and we've kind of gone back and forth as to how many caregivers are allowed. Because in statute, you can have whatever number that you want. Mm-hmm. So there has to be something, an administrative rule that limits it. Mm-hmm. The application has three. But clearly you can have more than three. So my question wasn't about everybody just taking off and go to Florida, although that was a scenario that the Deputy Commissioner and I had talked about early on in this development of this bill and now law. But the question is there now in rule an upper limit? Because when Deputy Commissioner Rowe said, well, 50 wouldn't be approved, probably because we had had that conversation early on as this was being crafted. I would hope 50 wouldn't be approved, but I'm wondering if there is a level at which you go, well, I think that's too much. And that's going to have to be, because it's not in statute, because legislators didn't say, here's the limit, it has to be decided by, you know, a lovely bureaucrat in an office to make that decision. So that was the impetus for the question that I had, but it is a real concern. Mm-hmm. Right? It was a real concern as we were crafting all of this, that when I look at how people are going to misuse and abuse this program, it is in when they say they are the caregiver and they have, you know, they've gone through this whole process and yet they take off 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, 6 weeks, 10 weeks, whatever it is, and they don't actually provide care. I think that is what all of our great concerns are. And of course, we want mothers and babies to have time together and have bonding time together. And, you know, the concept of the program is exactly what it should be. But I'm looking at the bad actors. That is our role in the Fraud Prevention and State Agency Oversight Committee, is we are trying to think like a bad actor. So we are giving you scenarios to say, here's a bad actor. This is what a bad actor could do. So hopefully that clarifies it. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And just to put a finer point on it, is there any upper limit on the number of caregivers in administrative rules, since there isn't one in statute? I think that's where we need to get an answer.
Yep, Madam Chair and Representative Rarick, thank you first just for kind of clarifying that. That's very helpful just in terms of it. So again, I'll answer it in a few parts, right? So what I would just say in terms of the approach that we're going to be taking here, right, is so I'll answer the brief part first, which is not in there is not a specific number in statute or rule. But let me elaborate on that response, because I think it's important to think about this, right? As we've kind of been talking about, there are a variety of, you know, family caregiving is complex. And in some cases, you might have a few people doing more limited parts, or you might have one person doing a lot, right? Like, and I think the statute and rules have been crafted to kind of recognize that, you know, those kinds of scenarios are complex. What I would say, though, is recognizing that complexity, we have administrative capabilities of ensuring that things are in line with what is reasonable, right? And, you know, when we talk about, like, if somebody has multiple caregivers, well, as part of that, the application for caregiving leave, you have to put in a schedule of caregiving, right? And so we will have administrative data that will state, like, how many people are approved to take caregiving leave at this specific time for this specific individual, right? Now, again, you don't necessarily want to say, you don't necessarily want to pick a specific number because life is complex. But I would just say we have a variety of, again, with those administrative data, we know who is going out. We know who's going to be taking leave for that purpose. We know how many of them are going to be taking leave for that purpose. And as Deputy Commissioner Eichten noted, if somebody is trying to game the system, there are, and as I discussed earlier, as part of this program, there are ample statutory tools for us to not pay benefits and to begin with, or if somebody misrepresents the record, to issue administrative or criminal penalties as may be appropriate, right? I think the other piece that I didn't mention that I would just note, in addition to the tips and reporting that you can have from employers and from the general public, is that, there's also going to be a random audit component of this. And we are certainly going to be, I wouldn't want to get into the specifics of a program audit the approach in public, but I would imagine that we will be looking at a variety of factors as we contemplate those items. But I do just want to emphasize, right, that through the data that we have in the collection of the application, we know who's tied to what caregivers and which caregivers are tied to which individuals. And we have a well-resourced program integrity team that will be reviewing these components as we go forward.
Thank you. Vice Chair Anderson.
Very quick, just a couple things. On FMLA, you talked about the caregivers and approving that. It's very different than this because FMLA is unpaid. And so people aren't going to be trying to get FMLA fraudulently, versus potentially they would with this. So it's very different. I also want to, as an employer, because there's no experience rating like unemployment, there is no incentive for an employer to turn someone in because they're, at a shopping mall versus taking someone, to chemo or whatever. So there's no employer incentive to help with the fraud issue. I can tell you that as an employer who has dealt with this for decades. The Representative Greenman talked about misclassification, and we're really talking about self-employed people, I'm going to talk about self-employed. So they can opt into this program, and I think as that happens, that I would want to watch that because a self-employed person could, back to your example of the migraines, could easily say they have migraines one day a week, they're their own employer, and they could get wages for 20% of their pay. So I actually think there's more potential for abuse or fraud or whatever in that case. So something to. I don't know if you've done anything about that or.
Thank you. Mr. Rowe.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Anderson. Thank you for that point. I think it's I would say in the statute there is a requirement that if you are a self-employed or independent contractor and you sign up for the program, you are required to participate in the program and pay premiums for at least 2 years as part of that. I would also just say that, the scenario you outline there is not something that the department has not contemplated. I think it is something that we will be watching carefully.
Thank you. We're going to go to Representative Elkins, but as he's asking his question, I see that Auditor Randall is in the audience, and I wondered if she would consent to coming, and I have a question for you, if you wouldn't mind. But Representative Elkins, you're next.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So I think we're getting a little off track here because this is a wage replacement program. No providers are being compensated as part of this program. If a provider wants to be compensated for the services they're providing, they're going to get compensated by an insurance company. And to Representative Schultz's point, they're not going to have to do anything that they wouldn't otherwise do in order to get paid by an insurance company. We're talking about going out from deed to existing electronic health record systems where the doctor or the whatever the kind of provider it is already documented that I provided this service to this patient because of this diagnosis. That's all we're going to be drawing from here. Using standard industry interfaces. So there's going to be like zero incremental burden on healthcare providers as part of this program. I think we're kind of gotten ourselves anchored on, you know, our experiences from examining a handful of DHS programs where entire new classes of providers have gotten invented without proper vetting, and it's coloring the way we're looking at everything else. And this is really a revolutionary way for us to approach the creation of a new benefit program. And in my 7 years here, this is only the second example I can think of, the first one being MnDrive, where legislation was crafted specifically to make it implementable. We worked, you know, I personally worked along with Representative Richardson, who was the primary author of the bill, with Deed to make sure that the law we were writing could be implemented in the way that Mr. Rowe is describing it today. So to try and, you know, force parallels between this program and some of the fraud-ridden programs we see seen in DHS, the parallels just aren't there. This is a model for the way that we need to be administering benefit programs going forward. And the stuff that, you know, Mr. Eichten is describing, you know, one of the problems we've had with some of these other programs we looked at is that they come up out of nowhere and they involve all kinds of paperwork that's specific to a particular program. They're not, you know, drawing data from other available sources to pre-populate the application forms. And so I think we're getting lost here because what's being described to us is so different from everything else that we've looked at. I've been very close to this program all the way through, and if it bombs on implementation, I'm going to take it personally. Because I really do believe that we're doing this right in this case, and it's going to pan out the way we're describing it. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Auditor Randall, for coming up. And when you start, please state your name for the record. My question is, you have audited a lot of programs. You have heard a lot today. And I know you have not actually audited this program. It's not even implemented yet. But when you think about the issues you see in other programs for internal controls, and honestly, my concern is some of the things we talked about the caregiver side with no upper limit. And I looked at the schedule, and Mr. Rowe, you can speak to this later, but I don't see any requirement for a caregiver intermittent schedule. I'm looking at the form. I don't see it. So maybe you can point that out to me. But to Auditor Randall, if you could help us, this program isn't live yet. If there are things you've heard today or concerns you have that we should be thinking about so that we can make sure this program, to Representative Elkin's point, doesn't have fraud. We're rooting for this not to have fraud. I don't want to have more fraud hearings, but I'm concerned because my reading of the statute, it's fairly vague, we've raised a lot of concerns today. So if you could just sort of address what you've heard and talk about what you think sort of the basic internal controls are that are the without which nothing are needed. Any thoughts you have for the committee would be appreciated. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. For the record, Judy Randall, legislative auditor. Excuse me. Nice to see all of you today. Let me just say, as auditors, we don't ever opine on something that we haven't audited. And we obviously have not audited this program. I'm sure I'm sure we will in years to come, so be warned, just because it's risky enough and enough money that it, you know, it will land on our radar screen. So I can't say anything definitive, of course. But I listened to the presentation, and honestly, I was impressed with a lot of it. I love that you have the green book on one of your slides. That's all the internal controls, which is what OLA audits against. You know, I don't know if you put that in for me, but I love that. And I think that's excellent that that's something that's that you're thinking about as you plan. I mean, I think we all have talked, and I've heard you talk about it, and I know as a legislature, you've all talked about how prevention is the most effective and the cheapest way to handle fraud. And so putting the controls in place up front is by far the most effective way. It's much better than pay and chase, which is what we have found ourselves doing in some of the programs Representative Elkins mentioned. So I think that's excellent. And I think a lot of the, I was taking copious notes during the presentation, and I think a lot of what you laid out were really good internal controls and procedures for that prevention piece. You know, the having policies and procedures for determining eligibility, for doing the identification verification through the login MN. So I think there's a lot of good things here. You know, the proof is in the pudding, and implementation is always what's key. And of course, I can't opine on that. The one thing I didn't hear mentioned, it doesn't mean it's not in place, but I would just raise this, is the procedures and plan for the investigations on the back end. So again, I know I just said it's better to prevent, yes, and I think it's excellent to put a lot of energy into that, but we also kind of acknowledge it might be impossible to have, you know, zero fraud, which Deputy Commissioner Eichten, I would just say that's always everyone's goal. I know. I believe it's attainable. But, you know, so having some policies and procedures, and my guess is you have those in place and you're limited in what you can say here. But just to make sure, you know, a lot of the internal controls are just really basic things. You know, whose responsibility is it, right? How do we identify which ones we're going to investigate? What metrics are we using? You know, when we do the data analytics, what are we looking for? What's going to raise a red flag? And then what are we doing with that? And again, I know that all seems obvious, but having that documented so everybody is on the same page is really important. Another thing I would just encourage is for you all to use all the authority you have in statute. I know there's a lot of desire and interest in getting these payments out quickly, right? I think the law has a two-week window, but I think the law also allows you to extend it if needed. And so having a policy or procedure for when is it needed, right? What constitutes a reasonable action for extending beyond those 2 weeks, and then using that ability if you do see things that raise red flags. But I don't think anything I'm saying is rocket science. I don't think anything I'm saying would be new to Deputy Commissioner Rowe. I'm encouraged. I'm hopeful. You know, but we'll be auditing. So,
but you know. Thank you, Auditor Randall. And Mr. Rowe, if you wouldn't mind responding specifically to her issue about how you will handle investigations, what will trigger an investigation, that would be useful. Thank you.
And Madam Chair, I don't want to say that there is a to the item that Auditor Randall noted, yes, we have we do have procedures and plans for how investigations will be conducted. You know, I think there, you know, as far as when do we conduct investigations, I'm not going to give you a comprehensive list here, but examples of things that would trigger investigations would be items that are suspicious, right, that we see at an individual level, right, in an application. You know, I think we spent a lot of time on kind of one particular scenario today. You know, I think things where we see, where we get incoming reports, obviously, that is the kind of thing that would trigger an investigation, right, whether through our fraud reporting, whether through an item that an employer raises as part of the program, whether it's something that doesn't look quite right on a certification form, right? Additionally, we'll be working closely with the Department of Labor and Industry, as far as workplace protections go. That is also the type of thing that could raise an integrity question. And I'll just, without going into gory detail, I'll just say that there's a variety of data analytics and other kinds of internal analyses that we will be doing to identify patterns. And when we see something suspicious, we will investigate it thoroughly. And I will just say, you know, our objective is to not issue any payment. You know, it will be to stop payments going out if we see something amiss.
Thank you for that. And just to be clear, so when you see something that's a credible allegation of fraud, you have authority currently for this program to stop payment?
Yes.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I know we're tight on time, but I just kind of a question and then a comment. I've overseen a lot of hearings about paid leave in my capacity as co-chair of the Jobs Committee, and I'm realizing I don't quite know the answer to this question. The certification process we've been talking about, and this will be just for the deed folks, I don't think only you, Auditor Randall, the certification process we've been talking about, that would be just for those employers that are choosing to go with the state system. If an employer chooses to go with a private plan, which is an employer's options, lots and lots of options in this program, those would be other certification processes. Is that right?
Mr. Rowe.
Madam Chair, Representative Pinto, that is correct. We expect the significant majority of employers will be using the state plan, but a significant minority of employers will be using equivalent plans. Those plans, while they are required to provide benefits that are at least as good or better than the state plan, I'd say that the process should presumably be similar, but they don't, you know, those insurers will have their own processes in place to validate claims.
Right, thank you. And then
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so then just a comment on that. And so just emphasizing then that, yeah, if an employer wants a certification process that has some other components and they can find a plan that offers that, they can do that as long as it's consistent with state law. So I appreciate that. And then just stepping back, our program, as has been referenced several times, has drawn from the experience of other states, incorporating some of the best practices. Actually, I gather we're the first state to actually have direct integration with electronic health records, which seems incredibly powerful. One of those lessons is that the kind of individual fraud that's been referenced here is vanishingly rare, which makes sense. I just want to kind of step back and recognize that unlike some of the other programs we've talked about, in terms of individual claims, it's something where there's a pre-existing relationship between an employee and an employer. And Commissioner Eichner, I so much appreciated the way you described it. The kinds of things that has been referenced here would require somebody to go out of their way. Again, you'd have 20 people looking for 50% wage replacement, exposing themselves to a ton of civil and criminal penalties. I work as a prosecutor outside the legislature. Very familiar. I look at these penalties. They can be gone after and potentially go to prison for a 50% wage replacement. Then they come back and resume what is presumably a position of trust with an employer because the employer is continuing to employ this person. So I think we just need to recognize the setup here. And by the way, if you have 20 people who are saying they're going to provide caregiving, you have to have a medical provider who would risk their license by then certifying 20 people. I will say that I found it especially disturbing the hypothetical that was brought up of maybe you've got a family member who is actually sick and they're living in some warm place, and maybe people take advantage of that by going, you know, grandma's dying, and also we get to have a paid vacation to Florida, and by the way, come back to the employer. For years, Minnesotans have been desperate for chances to be with their baby, to take time to deal with their own cancer diagnosis, to be with a dying family member. And for years, those efforts were blocked by a number of folks who I hear now just broadly, not necessarily in this hearing, but more broadly, bringing up the point saying that in fact, what we're going to do is spend a lot of energy blocking Minnesotans having access to that, as we heard through the years. If we spend as much energy ensuring that Minnesotans had the access to the benefits they were so desperate for, as we're now doing, focusing on these individual situations, my goodness, this would have happened a long, long time ago. So I'm very glad that now we're focusing that in January 1, Minnesotans will finally have access to these benefits. I share Auditor Randall's encouragement and a sense of really appreciating what you've described. And let's get out there and make sure that people finally get the time to be with their family members they've been so desperate for so long. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. So we are almost out of time, but I did have a couple of follow-up questions. First, the use of the electronic health records And that integration, I understand it's novel and that it might be providing some good data protection and data analysis work. Where was that authorized?
Madam Chair, authorized in what sense?
Was it authorized in statute that you would have access to the electronic health record system?
Madam Chair, so I think this is us working with the healthcare. This is us working with the health systems, right? So your Fairviews, your Mayos, et cetera, to provide a more straightforward, method of submitting certification paperwork that, you know, again, otherwise, you know, and again, other states use the paper-based process, and that has worked, as you've heard. But I think that this is really about, this is primarily about providing greater convenience and ease of use for, you know, these critical partners. I think who we heard committee members asking questions about what are ways that we can reduce the burden on medical providers. And I could look up for a specific statutory site, but I think that this is something that was well contemplated.
Thank you. Mr. Ecton, did you have a thought on that?
Madam Chair, thank you. Just to clarify, I think if the impression is that the department could have access to someone's medical records, that's incorrect, or that assumption is incorrect. We're talking about receiving via EDI, electronic data interchange, not the other acronym, information that is necessary from the medical provider in order to adjudicate the claim. So the authority for the information is what's laid out already in the paid leave statute that says you must collect this information from the medical provider in order to adjudicate the claim. There's a lot of ways to do that. If you think of the Department of Health, in some cases, it's a fax of the necessary information that they need for a particular program. In other cases, it's a portal online where someone goes and keys it in. Both of those are highly manual, labor-intensive, and costly. The most effective, efficient way to interchange data in terms of quality, speed, and low cost is via electronic data interchange, and these are established data exchange protocols that are in the healthcare industry. The novel piece is the willingness of the health systems in this state to engage with the state and start working on a plan to build that level of automation, which I think will be ultimately more secure, more efficient, and more accurate.
And if I could just add a...
Certainly, Mr. Rowe.
Yeah, and I guess you asked for a specific statutory citation. I think that would be found in the data practices section of Chapter 268B. So, I think we're authorized to do this with healthcare providers. I just note a couple other things, right? Like, we are working very carefully, as Deputy Commissioner Ecton noted, this is a, kind of standard electronic data interface kind of component that hospitals have used to build for other things, for a variety of other things. We actually think in many ways this improves data security even more strongly in the sense that, anybody who's worked in the medical field knows, physicians, medical providers, nurse practitioners, they live in Epic, they live in their EHR. And this is going to be a way to really smooth that process for all of them. And again, we're taking, in partnership with these health systems, working very carefully to ensure that, everything that we're doing is HIPAA compliant, that we're not collecting any unnecessary information. As Deputy Commissioner Ecton noted, we're not going to be accessing the medical records. What we're enabling is for a medical provider to not have to break out of their workflow that they, when they live in Epic so that they can send the data and then receive those data in a very useful format. Thank you
for clarifying that. I think when we were referencing earlier in the discussion electronic health records specifically, sure, that was how we were referring to it, and that honestly raised some red flags in my former role on the Judiciary Committee and a protege of Representative Scott. I just had to channel what I was hearing in my head. That's what Peggy would be asking. So I appreciate that, and I may actually have a follow-up email clarification on that. And then the last thing. Oh, we've got 2 minutes. Yikes. So many questions. So we've kind of beat the number of caregivers to death, honestly. But I do think it's important. It's been noted that the caregiver form is not necessarily, by my understanding, creating a schedule. And it's not necessary that the individual who is seeking caregiver leave gets that authorized by the person who's providing care. Like, would the one doctor who's the care of the patient, who's in care of the patient who needs the care, is that the one doctor responsible for certifying all caregivers, or can they kind of find other providers to certify that they should play the role of caregiver?
Okay. Madam Chair, so to the first, you know, to the first part. So it's not on the certification form because this is actually going to be, the schedule is something that would be submitted as part of the application for caregiving leave. So obviously we've got, you know, there's the certification form, that's the medical provider saying this is essential, for this. But as part of the application flow, when the individual who is providing the caregiving leave is going to be submitting their application, that's where we collect that information around the leave schedules and those pieces. So that's, you know, so if you don't see it on that form, that's because it's part of the application flow that will be going live. It's one doctor per person needing leave. So the individual who is seeking, you know, who needs the care, that needs to be tied to one physician, and that is something that the department will be monitoring.
And so the person, if I'm applying for leave to care for my grandmother, I have to go to my grandmother's doctor to get them to certify, or I go to my own doctor and just say, hey, can you certify? I need to go take care of my grandmother.
If I'm understanding the question right, I think the grandparent or the grandmother in this case would have gone to her doctor. Right. And and the doctor would have to certify that she has something, you know, that she has a condition requiring caregiving leave. And it would be that doctor that would need to sign off on the caregiver or caregivers in this case.
So the caregiver also has to go to the same doctor. So there can't be multiple doctors involved in certifying caregiver leave.
That's correct.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you. Mr. Rowe, Mr. Ecton, Auditor Randall, thank you for participating in this hearing. It is our strong hope that the internal controls in this program are robust and followed, because we do not want to be back here a year from now having a fraud hearing. So I appreciate your hard work on this, and we look forward to your success.
Thank you, Madam Chair.